Chapter 11. Man or woman in distress can obtain a loan for 1% a month. It's wonderful. I've been interested in all I've heard today, especially in the romances recounted by Mrs. Thomas, which reminds me that I have a romance of my own in my autobiography, which I am building for the instruction of the world. In San Francisco, many years ago, when I was a newspaper reporter, perhaps I should say I had been and was willing to be, a pawnbroker was taking care of what property I had. There was a friend of mine, a poet, out of a job, and he was having a hard time of it too. There was passage in it, but I guess I've got to keep that for the autobiography. Well, my friend the poet thought his life was a failure, and I told him I thought it was, and then he said he thought he ought to commit suicide, and I said, LL right, which was disinterested advice to a friend in trouble, but, like all such advice, there was just a little bit of self-interest back of it, for if I could get a coupon the other newspapers I could get a job. The poet could be spared, and so, largely for his own good and partly for mine, I kept the thing in his mind, which was necessary, as would-be suicides are very changeable and hard to hold to their purpose. He had a preference for a pistol, which was an extravagance, for we hadn't enough between us to hire a pistol. A fork would have been easier. And so he concluded to drown himself, and I said it was an excellent idea, the only trouble being that he was so good a swimmer. So we went down to the beach. I went along to see that the thing was done right. Then something most romantic happened. There came in on the sea something that had been on its way for 3 years. It rolled in across the broad Pacific with a message that was full of meaning to that poor poet, and cast itself at his feet. It was a life preserver. This was a complication. And then I had an idea he never had any, especially when he was going to write poetry. I suggested that we pawn the life preserver and get a revolver. The pawnbroker gave us an old Derringer with a bullet as big as a hickory nut. When he heard that it was only a poet that was going to kill himself, he did not quibble. Well, we succeeded in sending a bullet right through his head. It was a terrible moment when he placed that pistol against his forehead and stood for an instant. I said, "Oh, pull the trigger." And he did, and cleaned out all the gray matter in his brains. It carried the poetic faculty away, and now he's a useful member of society. Now, therefore, I realize that there's no more beneficent institution than this penny fund of yours, and I want all the poets to know this. I did think about writing you a check, but now I think I'll send you a few copies of what one of your little members called Strawberry Finn. Public Education Association, address at a meeting of the Berkeley Lyceum, New York, November 23, 1900. I don't suppose that I am called here as an expert on education, for that would show a lack of foresight on your part and a deliberate intention to remind me of my shortcomings. As I sat here looking around for an idea, it struck me that I was called for two reasons. One was to do good to me, a poor unfortunate traveler on the world's wide ocean, by giving me a knowledge of the nature and scope of your society and letting me know that others beside myself have been of some use in the world. The other reason that I can see is that you have called me to show by way of contrast what education can accomplish if administered in the right sort of doses. Your worthy president said that the school pictures, which have received the admiration of the world at the Paris Exposition, have been sent to Russia, and this was a compliment from that government which is very surprising to me. Why, it is only an hour since I read a cablegram in the newspapers beginning, "Russia proposes to retrench." I was not expecting such a thunderbolt, and I thought what a happy thing it will be for Russians when the retrenchment will bring home the 30,000 Russian troops now in Manchuria to live in peaceful pursuits. I thought this was what Germany should do also without delay, and that France and all the other nations in China should follow suit. Why should not China be free from the foreigners, who are only making trouble on her soil? If they would only all go home, what a pleasant place China would be for the Chinese. We do not allow Chinamen to come here, and I say in all seriousness that it would be a graceful thing to let China decide who shall go there. China never wanted foreigners any more than foreigners wanted Chinamen, and on this question I am with the Boxers every time. The Boxer is a patriot. He loves his country better than he does the countries of other people. I wish him success. The Boxer believes in driving us out of his country. I am a Boxer too, for I believe in driving him out of our country. When I read the Russian dispatch further, my dream of world peace vanished. It said that the vast expense of maintaining the army had made it necessary to retrench, and so the government had decided that to support the army it would be necessary to withdraw the appropriation from the public schools. This is a monstrous idea to us. We believe that out of the public school grows the greatness of a nation. It is curious to reflect how history repeats itself the world over. Why, I remember the same thing was done when I was a boy on the Mississippi River. There was a proposition in a township there to discontinue public schools because they were too expensive. An old farmer spoke up and said, if they stopped the schools they would not save anything, because every time a school was closed a jail had to be built. It's like feeding a dog on his own tail. He'll never get fat. I believe it is better to support schools than jails. The work of your association is better and shows more wisdom than the Tsar of Russia and all his people. This is not much of a compliment, but it's the best I've got in stock. Education and Citizenship. On the evening of May 14, 1908, the alumni of the College of the City of New York celebrated the opening of the new college buildings at a banquet in the Waldorf Astoria. Mr. Clemens followed Mayor McClellan. I agreed when the mayor said that there was not a man within hearing who did not agree that citizenship should be placed above everything else, even learning. Have you ever thought about this? Is there a college in the whole country where there is a chair of good citizenship? There is a kind of bad citizenship which is taught in the schools, but no real good citizenship taught. There are some which teach insane citizenship, bastard citizenship, but that is all. Patriotism. Yes, but patriotism is usually the refuge of the scoundrel. He is the man who talks the loudest. You can begin that chair of citizenship in the College of the City of New York. You can place it above mathematics and literature, and that is where it belongs. We used to trust in God. I think it was in 1863 that some genius suggested that it be put upon the gold and silver coins which circulated among the rich. They didn't put it on the nickels and coppers because they didn't think the poor folks had any trust in God. Good citizenship would teach accuracy of thinking and accuracy of statement. Now, that motto on the coin is an overstatement. Those congressmen had no right to commit this whole country to a theological doctrine. But since they did, Congress ought to state what our creed should be. There was never a nation in the world that put its whole trust in God. It is a statement made on insufficient evidence. Leaving out the gamblers, the burglars, and the plumbers, perhaps we do put our trust in God after a fashion. But, after all, it is an overstatement. If the cholera or black plague should come to these shores, perhaps the bulk of the nation would pray to be delivered from it, but the rest would put their trust in the health board of the city of New York. I read in the papers within the last day or two of a poor young girl who they said was a leper. Did the people in that populous section of the country where she was, did they put their trust in God? The girl was afflicted with the leprosy, a disease which cannot be communicated from one person to another. Yet, instead of putting their trust in God, they harried that poor creature, shelterless and friendless, from place to place, exactly as they did in the Middle Ages, when they made lepers wear bells, so that people could be warned of their approach and avoid them. Perhaps those people in the Middle Ages thought they were putting their trust in God. The president ordered the removal of that motto from the coin, and I thought that it was well. I thought that overstatement should not stay there. But I think it would better read, within certain judicious limitations we trust in God, and if there isn't enough room on the coin for this, why, enlarge the coin. Now I want to tell a story about jumping at conclusions. It was told to me by Bram Stoker, and it concerns a christening. There was a little clergyman who was prone to jump at conclusions sometimes. One day he was invited to officiate at a christening. He went. There sat the relatives, intelligent-looking relatives they were. The little clergyman's instinct came to him to make a great speech. He was given to flights of oratory, that way a very dangerous thing, for often the wings which take one into clouds of oratorical enthusiasm, are wax and melt up there, and down you come. But the little clergyman couldn't resist. He took the child in his arms, and, holding it, looked at it a moment. It wasn't much of a child. It was little, like a sweet potato. Then the little clergyman waited impressively, and then I see in your countenances, he said, disappointment of him. I see you are disappointed with this baby. Why? Because he is so little. My friends, if you had but the power of looking into the future, you might see that great things may come of little things. There is the great ocean, holding the navies of the world, which comes from little drops of water no larger than a woman's tears. There are the great constellations in the sky, made up of little bits of stars. Oh, if you could consider his future, you might see that he might become the greatest poet of the universe, the greatest warrior the world has ever known, greater than Caesar, than Hannibal, than turning to the father, that's his name? The father hesitated, then whispered back, his name? Well, his name is Marianne. Courage, at a beefsteak dinner, given by artists, caricaturists, and humorists of New York City, April 18, 1908, Mr. Clemens, Mr. H.H. Rogers, and Mr. Patrick McCarran were the guests of honor. Each wore a white apron, and each made a short speech. In the matter of courage, we all have our limits. There never was a hero who did not have his bounds. I suppose it may be said of Nelson, and all the others whose courage has been advertised, that there came times in their lives, when their bravery knew it had come to its limit. I have found mine a good many times. Sometimes this was expected, often it was unexpected. I know a man who is not afraid to sleep with a rattlesnake, but you could not get him to sleep with a safety razor. I never had the courage to talk across a long, narrow room. I should be at the end of the room facing all the audience. If I attempt to talk across a room, I find myself turning this way and that, and thus at alternate periods I have part of the audience behind me. You ought never to have any part of the audience behind you. You never can tell what they are going to do. I'll sit down. The dinner to Mr. Choate, at a dinner given in honor of Ambassador Joseph H. Choate at the Lotos Club, November 24, 7902, the speakers, among others, were Senator Depew, William Henry White, Speaker Thomas Reed, and Mr. Choate. Mr. Clemens spoke, in part, as follows. The greatness of this country rests on two anecdotes. The first one is that of Washington and his hatchet, representing the foundation of true speaking, which is the characteristic of our people. The second one is an old one, and I've been waiting to hear it tonight. But as nobody has told it yet, I will tell it. You've heard it before, and you'll hear it many, many times more. It is an anecdote of our guest, of the time when he was engaged as a young man with a gentle Hebrew, in the process of skinning the client. The main part in that business is the collection of the bill for services in skinning the man. Services is the term used in that craft for the operation of that kind diplomatic in its nature. Choate's correspondent made out a bill for $500 for his services, so called. But Choate told him he had better leave the matter to him, and the next day he collected the bill for the services, and handed the Hebrew $5,000, saying, "That's your half of the loot," and inducing that memorable response, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." The deep thinkers didn't merely laugh when that happened. They stopped to think and said, "Here's a rising man. He must be rescued from the law and consecrated to diplomacy. The commercial advantages of a great nation lie there in that man's keeping. We no longer require a man to take care of our moral character before the world. Washington and his anecdote have done that. We require a man to take care of our commercial prosperity." Mr. Choate has carried that trait with him, and, as Mr. Carnegie has said, he has worked like a mole underground. We see the result when American railroad iron is sold so cheap in England that the poorest family can have it. He has so beguiled that cabinet of England. He has been spreading the commerce of this nation and has depressed English commerce in the same ratio. This was the principle underlying that anecdote, and the wise men saw it. The principle of give and take, give one and take ten, the principle of diplomacy. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.